This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Okay, everybody, welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. Again, this is your host, Charles Giuliani. I've been calling myself a guest host, but I guess by now you've probably figured out, it took me a while to figure it out. I'm not just guesting, I'm pretty much a regular here on the People Speak. I enjoy that. I hope you're all enjoying it as well. Today we have a very interesting guest. His name is Miko, is it Peled or Peled?
Peled.
Miko Peled. He's got a very interesting story. In fact, that's the purpose of his book here. It's called The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. His father was a soldier in the IDF, and he tells his story of you know, of his father's experience, of his experience, and his not so happy discovery that things haven't been working quite the way so many people have been led to think that they work. You know, what's been going on with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and of course, I want to get him to tell his story, and then later in the broadcast, we'll get his opinion on, you know, what's been happening, especially in the past few weeks with the fighting that's been going on over there. It's very disturbing. So anyway, yeah, welcome to the show, Miko. Great to have you on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Before we begin, I actually forgot to do this last week with our guest. Later on in the show, I'll have you do it as well. But if you could mention where people can go, I'm sure on Amazon, but do you have a website as well? Anything you wanted to plug where people can look at your work?
To get the book, best place to get the book is generalsun.com. The book is called The General's Son, like you said, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and the best place to get it is online at thegeneralsun.com. It is available on Amazon, too. But from what I understand, getting it on thegeneralsun.com, which is the book website, it's much easier.
Okay, so again, The General's Son, and obviously no apostrophe.
No, just one word.
TheGeneralsSon.com. Okay, and of course Amazon, but there's probably a lot more information on your website as well.
There is, yeah.
Sure, right. So go check that out, folks. Okay, let's jump right in here. Tell us about your father's involvement and your awakening over the years, you know, how you came to see things in a different light, I guess we could say.
Yeah, well, you know, my father, like you said, my father was an officer before actually the Israeli army was an army, before the state was a state. It was the militia, kind of the Jewish militia in Palestine. And later on, when the State of Israel was created, was established in 1948, that militia became the Israeli army, and he became an officer in the Israeli army, and he had a long military career, a very distinguished military career. And in 1967, he was a general in the war of 1967. He was one of the generals that planned the war, pushed for the war, and then executed the war of 1967. And then later on, even before he retired, he began speaking about the need for Israel to stop being this military aggressive force and start working for peace. His point was that Israel had established itself as a military power, and now, in order to guarantee its existence, it needs to pursue peace, and mainly with the Palestinians, he said, because even though Israel conquered the entire country, which of course was called Palestine before Israel changed the name and called it Israel, even though Israel conquered the entire country and really kicked out many, many of the Palestinians, still there were Palestinians there, and still Israelis and Palestinians were sharing this land. And he said, if Israel does not work out an agreement with the Palestinians, it will either not be a Jewish state, because there's a large Palestinian minority, almost 50% of the population are Palestinians, or it won't be a democracy, because when you have a Jewish state where half the population is not Jewish, then you've got to keep that other half that's not Jewish in prisons and in occupation and so forth. And so,
right.
So from that point on, he kind of parted with the rest of the establishment, because everybody else said, are you crazy? We're not going to give back lands. We're not going to make peace with these people. We just conquered the land. We're going to get rid of them. And for the last, you know, that's exactly what Israel's been doing. They've been pushing Palestinians off their land and building cities and towns and roads and everything, but for Israeli Jews only. And that's why we still have a problem. And he dedicated the remainder of his life, he died in 1995, to pursuing that cause, the cause of peace with the Palestinians, and also as an advocate for Palestinian rights in general.
And so obviously his awakening became yours.
And then his awakening was really the first step of my awakening. I was not really active in any way. I had my opinions, but you know, I chose not to be
involved,
active in this area until much later in life.
So did this come before your father had died or after for you?
It came after he died. 2 years after my father died, and you know, I talk about this in the book. Two years after my father died, my sister's little girl was killed in a suicide attack in Jerusalem.
Mm, wow.
Two young Palestinians blew themselves up and took her along with several other Israelis. And
not an uncommon thing.
Well, it's not an uncommon thing, and it was big news in Israel, because here's the granddaughter of a well-known general and also the granddaughter of a man who was an advocate for Palestinian rights, and look what happened to his granddaughter. And when my sister, her mother, you know, came out, and you know, because there was a lot of press, and of course, you know, their apartment was full of reporters, and everybody came to, you know, report on this. She was asked, you know, who she thought was responsible, and what do you think about retaliation, and all that kind of thing. And she said, well, first of all, she said, no real mother would want to see this happen to another mother, so don't talk to me about retaliation, and don't talk to me about killing other people.
Mm.
The people that killed my daughter killed themselves too. Number two, she said, in terms of who's responsible, she said, these two young men, you know, were brought to such a level of despair and hopelessness that they're willing to take their own lives and take the lives of innocent civilians, including my daughter, she said. But who brought them to such a level of despair? It's the Israeli occupation. It's the Israeli oppression of the Palestinians that brought them to such despair, because when you kick people out of their homes and you kill and incarcerate their fathers and their older siblings, and you shoot their younger brothers and sisters in their schools, and you give them no hope, no land, no freedom, no rights, this is what happens. And she said, right. I hold the Israeli government directly responsible for my daughter's death.
Wow.
So, of course, this was even bigger news, because here's a bereaved mother completely changing the story, turning the story on its head. The story that people always hear is the Israelis are victims and the Palestinians are terrorists.
Sure.
Here she's saying the Palestinians are being deprived of their rights and their land and of their freedom, and that this is the price that we, the Israelis, have to pay when we are the oppressors.
Now, where was your father at this point? Is this after
he had
died?
He already passed away.
Oh, okay.
He was spared this.
So I don't imagine he or your mother, and of course you now, are very popular in Israel.
Well, he was very well respected, but of course he wasn't popular because of what he thought. And after my sister, you know, I was already living in the States at the time. After I heard my sister say these things, I came back here, and you have to do something. I mean, your life completely changes. You know, when you see
sure.
the coffin of a 13-year-old little girl being buried, it's insane.
I meant the government. Yeah, would you say that there's a fairly large percentage of the population, though, that opposed to Israel's policy to the Palestinians?
Not in Israel, no. I mean, look at the result of the elections. Every single time you get the people like Netanyahu and others in office. And so the Israelis are obviously happy with what's going on. Or at least this is what they want.
There is a group of, a movement of resistance, but it's not probably very major, huh?
It's very small.
Yeah.
It's very, very small. But so when I came here, I became active. I decided to become active. I decided to learn about the Palestinian issue. I decided to meet Palestinians. And, you know, I talk about this in my book. I was born and raised in Jerusalem, which is supposed to be a mixed city. But the first time I ever sat with Palestinians was here in the United States, here in San Diego, because Jerusalem is so segregated. The entire country is completely segregated. So it's not like you see Israelis and Palestinians doing things together.
Were you actually born over there?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Jerusalem, yes.
I don't detect any accent at all. You must have come over when you were young, huh?
Well, I've been here several times before I actually ended up living here. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I honestly don't pick up any accent. I have a friend who's from Israel. He's been here probably 20 years, but he still has a very, very heavy accent. So a lot of people have a hard time understanding
him,
in fact. It's amazing. I would never know. But anyway, so you saw how your father was, and now you see your mother being that way. Is this about the time that you started to come around? You know, did your mother inspire you, even though it was her own relative that...
I came back here and I began, like I said, meeting with Palestinians and then I began traveling. When I'd visit back Israel, I would go to Palestinian cities and I'd go to Palestinian territories. I'd go to the West Bank, and you know, Israel has a law that prohibits Israelis from going into Palestinian cities. And you see this big red sign every time you cross a checkpoint that says that it's forbidden for Israelis to travel to the Palestinian areas. It's a felony, it's life-threatening, and you know, and so forth. But I did it anyway. The first time it was scary, the second time it was less scary. Now I've been doing it for 10 years, and I still haven't found the danger or the threat. I don't know why it's a felony. I don't know why they think it's threatening. I still haven't seen a single Palestinian who cares whether or not I'm there, who cares if I'm an Israeli, or has any intention to harm me. So I have to come to the conclusion that the reason they want... that they're trying to keep Israelis afraid is because that's how you keep the two sides apart. And as long as you keep the two sides apart, Israel can continue with its aggressive policies of oppression, and nobody says anything. So as long as you have the Israelis are afraid and the Palestinians are frustrated and they never come together and see each other, they can continue this insane policy of, you know.
Do you address it all in the book, the fact of the U.S. government being ominously, almost completely silent when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian issue? They seem to never say or do anything. They profess to be concerned about human rights and, you know, ethnic cleansing, you know, on and on. How many countries have we invaded under those pretexts? But ominously silent when it comes to, you know, Israeli treatment of Palestinians. Do you address that in the book at all? Or?
Yeah, America is ominously silent when it comes to Israeli crimes against the Palestinians, but it's not really that it's silent. America gives, you know, somewhere between $3 and $5 billion a year to Israel, and Israel uses that money to build this massive military force that is then being used to kill and terrorize Palestinians.
Which, of course, is worse than being silent.
So they're not being silent, they're being complicit, really, and then they're
faking
it by saying, well, Israel has the right to defend itself. But Israel is not defending itself. Israel is the aggressor here. So self-defense claim is really holds no water.
Yeah,
I use
the illustration.
That's a big part of the problem.
You know, it's a David and Goliath situation. You know, does Goliath really need defense against...
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, it's very upsetting. I'm sure you know about... Rachel Corrie, not too long ago we had her parents here on the show. I interviewed them.
Oh, wonderful people, of course. I know them well.
Yeah, that was a very, very interesting interview. So I'm sure you've met them probably several occasions.
Yes, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Wonderful people.
Very,
wonderful,
very, very sad. What's that?
I said they're wonderfully determined and they won't stop. They're seeking justice for their daughter's death and I commend them for it.
Yeah, they're really honoring her memory. It's great. I actually have a question here already coming in. This is from Mike in California. He asks, in light of the recent recognition by the UN of Palestine, do you think that this will impede a one-state solution as it seems to be headed toward a fight for Palestinian sovereignty?
Yeah, you know, The UN vote has really no bearing on the ground. I mean, it was a symbolic thing. Everybody knows Israel is still in charge. Everybody knows Israel will never allow the Palestinians to establish their own state. And therefore, the only solution that remains is changing Israel, that controls the entire country with half the population being Palestinian, into a real democracy where Palestinians do have a right to vote and have freedoms and so on and so forth and are equal to Israelis. So I don't think I think the vote is a good thing because it demonstrates that the world is with Palestine and the world is showing its solidarity to the Palestinian cause. But in terms of a real political solution, I think it's meaningless because the only solution that is possible is transforming Israel into a real democracy.
Yeah, I'd kind of like to get your take on this. I'm very suspicious of the UN for a lot of reasons. But when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian issue there as well, I'm suspicious because, I mean, let's face it, you go back to the very beginning of the UN's history. This was, of course, you know, right at the time, pretty much the same time Israel was being created. The UN steps in, as I'm sure you know, and I don't, you know, out of nowhere, simply decides to hand over to Israel, what was it, 47% of Palestine or something
57.
Like that? 57, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, where did they get off doing that, number one? And number two, whose side are they really on here?
Well, this was, you know, in the aftermath of the Holocaust and the world feeling guilty and the Zionist, this is before it was in Israel, but the Zionist diplomatic corps, of which my grandfather was a big part, did a lot of work behind the scenes, a lot of work to get that vote through. And the vote basically said, the resolution said, that, you know, close to 60%, 56 or 57% of the country will go to the small community of Jewish immigrants who were living in Palestine at the time, and they would get the lion's share of the country, which was, of course, absurd. Then they went on to say, well, the Palestinians were foolish not to accept this. Well, they called them the Arabs. They didn't call them Palestinians. And then they said, then they claimed that the war of 1948 began when the Palestinians attacked the Jewish community, which is not true. It was the other way around. But the UN, yeah, the UN, it was an absurd resolution. It was an absurd map, and it was an absurd proposition that the Palestinians would somehow accept that a small, less than half a million, a community of less than half a million immigrants would get the lion's share of their country. I mean, who would accept something like that? And then, of course, it wasn't the Palestinians who began the fight, because the Palestinians didn't have a fighting force. The Jews did. The Zionists had a very strong militia of almost 40,000 well-armed and trained men who began a massive campaign of ethnic cleansing as soon as the UN vote was completed. But I think today, you know, the UN, of course, is toothless because Israel does not obey any, does not obey any of the UN resolutions when it comes to Palestine.
And but of course, with the UN, you know, with the US backing them, having veto power,
exactly.
There you go.
Exactly. But on this particular vote, I think the UN voted well with Palestine, as I think it's a disgrace that the US voted did not vote with Palestine. But the rest of the world did, and that, I think that was a good thing.
Well, I know, you know, the more they do this, they're making themselves look worse and worse, because there is a growing number of people around the world, and here in the United States, as I'm sure you've seen as well, of people getting disgusted with the way our government has been, you know, dealing with this situation. And so, you know, they can't get away with it so easily as they have in the past. There's big outcries around the world, across Europe. You know, the gig is going to be up here pretty soon if they don't start changing their policies.
It's true. There's a great change that's taking place here in the United States, and it's happening on several fronts. You've got, you know, there's this image here that the Jewish community, American Jewish community as a whole, is Zionist and supports Israel, and it's not true. You know, there's a very large number of American Jews who support the Palestinian cause, and I see this. As I go around the country and speak everywhere, I see this on college campuses with young Jewish students who are part of the pro-Palestinian groups on campuses, and we're talking about hundreds of campuses, hundreds of events every year. I see this in other peace groups, people that invite me to speak. You know, a large portion of them are American Jews. So there are a lot of American Jews who are not part of the mainstream community that has taken on the support of Israel. So that's one thing that's absolutely clear. The Jewish community in America is certainly not 100% behind Israel. The second thing is, on campuses, you see a lot of work, you see a lot of campaigns, you see many events all over the country every single year, and they grow year by year, where students are organizing events that they have checkpoints in the middle of the campus. They build walls. They do these amazing displays, week long displays. They bring wonderful speakers. And they educate the student bodies, and they educate the people on campus on this issue. And then the third part where you see big change, is there's a movement, a growing movement, called the BDS movement, which is the boycott, divest, and impose sanctions on Israel. It's the BDS movement, and it's growing in leaps and bounds. More companies, more churches are buying into this notion of this way of BDS being a tool of resistance to stand up against the Israeli crimes towards the Palestinians. So there is a big change in this country. There's no question about that.
You mentioned churches. That's good to hear, because I'm sure you know a great many churches have been very often more pro-Israel even than Israelis.
Yeah, those are some of those evangelist, Zionist churches. But take the Presbyterians, you take the Methodists, a large portion of the Episcopalian Church and so forth. They are very much in tune with the fact that Israel is a criminal state that has to be held back and has to be stopped. And they've taken some very brave resolutions, and they've taken some very brave steps to support the Palestinian cause.
What do you think? Well, I can pretty much guess what you think, but what do you think needs to be done about things like AIPAC?
Well, AIPAC is a very effective lobby. That's why America is so much. That's why American politicians and the media and so forth are behind Israel, because AIPAC is a very strong, very effective lobby that's been it's been effective, and it's been like this for decades. This is not a new thing, and
right.
It's got several arms. It's got the Jewish Federation. It's got Hillel. It's got a whole bunch of different arms that work in different fields in different areas. And the thing to do is just completely to ignore them. It's what you do when there's a bully in town. If you have a bully, if you don't stand up to the bully, then the bully is going to push you around. Problem is, American politicians don't want to stand up to it. They'd rather, if you look at the president, for example, he has to bow to every demand and every request that Israel makes, because otherwise AIPAC will make sure that his life is hell and no other piece of his agenda, of his political agenda, will ever materialize.
Yeah.
So for a politician to stand up to Israel and to stand up to AIPAC may mean that they have to give up their political career.
Political suicide, yeah.
But it's tough. It's a very
right.
tough thing to do.
Yeah, it is a very difficult situation, and they've done it. I mean, they've taken politicians.
They have. I mean,
down.
They've been Americans. They've been politicians, congressmen, senators who've lost their seats because of this. Yes, because of this issue.
Very powerful and out of proportion influence. It's very
completely,
sad.
Completely out of proportion and unjustifiable. I mean, it's not like Israel is some kind of a poor country, developing country that needs aid. Israel doesn't need the foreign aid. This is $3-5 billion every single year that's going to subsidize ethnic cleansing. It's going to subsidize the building of towns and cities for Israelis only at the expense of Palestinians. It's money that's going for the wrong reason. If you want to help other countries, there are plenty of developing countries that could use the money otherwise.
Yeah, the whole foreign aid thing is, to me, unfortunately, it's a big sick joke, because very often, almost always, in fact, foreign aid never actually goes to people in need. It goes to corrupt dictators to keep them compliant.
True.
It's kind of buy-off money. The whole
True.
Thing needs to go. We got so much falling apart over here that needs fixing, and billions of dollars. But it's especially sad, like you said, when you see this money going to a country that has consistently been using it for aggressive human rights abuse purposes.
True, absolutely true. And thankfully, in Egypt at least, they managed to get rid of one dictator. Hopefully they'll be able to keep other dictators out as well. But you're right. I mean, a large portion of this money goes to bribe to corrupt dictators and really not to foreign aid. But
right.
not much of it does. I mean, but certainly in the case of Israel, it's tragic, because Israel is a wealthy country that does not need the aid.
Sure. You mentioned actually before the show started, we were talking. You mentioned that you're going to be coming into Boston. You're going to be going to amongst other places, MIT. Does that involve meeting with Mr. Chomsky there? Have you ever actually met with him before, worked with him? Because I know he's talked about this issue himself.
Yeah, I hope to meet with him. I don't know. The agenda and the itinerary of the trip is still being put together, so I don't know for sure who I'm going to meet and when. I'd welcome an opportunity to meet with him, of course.
Right. Anyway, we got some more questions coming in here. We've got, this is from Jordan, somewhere in the U.S., he says, have you heard of, I want to make sure I pronounce this right here, Sheministim?
Oh, yeah, the Sheministim, yes. Sheministims are senior, high school seniors. That's how you say high school seniors in Hebrew. And the Sheministim,
oh, okay.
There was a famous letter that was put together by a group of high school seniors, and more every single year others sign on to it, which basically says that they refuse to serve in the Israeli army. Now, this is a very, very brave group of young men and women, because, you know, men and women are have to serve in the Israeli army.
Yeah.
But it's important to realize this. It's important to note this. It's very easy to get out of the draft, because the Israeli army is too big, and they don't want people who aren't interested in being part of it. So, you know, if you have a bad knee or a bad back or you miss your mommy, you could get out of the draft. The only thing that is not permissible is to be a conscientious objector. So these guys, these kids who identify with this particular letter, the Shministim, they know very well that they could get out of the draft if they wanted to by claiming that they have, you know, some other reason. But they do, on principle, they won't do that. On principle, they claim that they will not serve for political reasons and for conscientious reasons.
And they should be able to do that.
And they go to jail.
Yeah.
And they serve up to, and they put them in prison. They receive prison sentences up to a year. And the judges usually insist that they sit with hardened criminals. So they are really being punished severely for standing up to the principles and for being truthful. And this is a very, very, we're talking about a couple thousand people here. It's not a small group of very principled, very dedicated people who are paying, young people who are paying a heavy price. And then later on, it's very difficult in Israeli society if you did not serve. And they do it anyway.
So we'll let you out of service as long as you say that what we're doing is good.
Exactly.
Mind control. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, of course.
I mean, you know, not even the semblance of freedom of speech or...
No, and they don't even pretend. It's not a semblance of freedom of speech. It's not a semblance of democracy. It's really quite a joke when they call Israel a democracy when it has thousands of political prisoners, Palestinian political prisoners, thousands of them. They call them terrorists. But less than 10% were ever charged with any acts of violence. Less than 10%, and we're talking about thousands and thousands of men and women and minors who sit in Israeli prisons, sometimes without due process. Sometimes, you know, they sit in jail for years before they're even brought to trial. And we're talking about, you know, like lately, like you mentioned earlier, that what happened in Gaza, Israel dropped tons and tons of bombs on a completely civilian population in Gaza, causing horrendous, death and destruction. And all this is being done somehow, but in the name of democracy. What democracy? You know, why are they doing this? They're only doing this because they're trying to destroy another nation. They're trying to destroy the Palestinians.
Yeah, going back to Herzl, and of course many prominent Israeli leaders over the years have echoed those same sentiments. Literally, you know, David Ben-Gurion, for example, came right out and said that, you know, this has always been their goal. This is what we intend to do. We're going to crush them out. We're going to give them missiles without relish, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, people often make the mistake of saying, well, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, isn't good, but there are good forces, and Israel could have been this liberal democracy, but it's a complete misreading of what Israel is about, and it's a complete misreading of the history of Zionism and the state of Israel, because from the very beginning, from Ben-Gurion and onwards, every Israeli prime minister and every Israeli defense minister and the entire Israeli army have been dedicated to ethnic cleansing. They've been dedicated to destroying the Palestinians. And they've been dedicated to making sure they attack and destroy and terrorize the Palestinians at every opportunity. And they've been doing it for 65 years, and they're not about to stop. So Benjamin Netanyahu is not the problem. The problem is that the state of Israel as a state and Zionism as an ideology are intent on destroying the Palestinians, and therefore the solution, and I know this sounds terrible when I say this, the solution is to transform Israel from a Jewish state, which is a racist idea, into a democracy where it's not a Jewish state. It's the state of all the people who live there, half of whom are Palestinians.
Right. It's just completely unfair, and that's putting it mildly.
And people are afraid to say, you know, the end of the Jewish state. They say, see, you talk like Ahmadinejad, or you're anti-Semitic, and it's nonsense. You know, most Jews haven't bought into the idea of a Jewish state. Even after the Holocaust, most Jews preferred not to come to Israel, but to go to other places and to other countries. So it's not like all Jews support the idea of a Jewish state. But the small group of Jews who created the Jewish state decided they represent all Jews, and that's it. But it's not true. And it's a racist idea. It's a bad idea, and it was catastrophic. I mean, it brought death and destruction on millions of people.
And still continues to do so.
And still continues to do so, of course.
Which brings us to the you know, this recent, what do we call it, carnage that has gone on. I've seen some of the footages on YouTube, you know, some of the horror. Oh, it's just, it just brings tears to your eyes. Indiscriminately targeting, you know, the most horrible victims, of course, are little children. There's just no need of this.
No, but the thing is, you can't avoid it. Israel knows, and the Israeli commanders know, and the Israeli soldiers know, and the Air Force pilots know that when they bomb Gaza, they will kill civilians and they will kill children, because that's all you have there. There's never been an army. There are no tanks in Gaza. There are no warplanes in Gaza. There never have been. There are no warships. You know, Gaza, the people in Gaza have been locked in this in a concentration camp for years now. And Israel got control of everything. They can't leave. They can't import. They can't export. They can't work. And they have to suffer periodical massive attacks via the Israeli military. And you know for sure, with a population that is that dense, I think it's one of the most densely populated areas in the world.
In the world, sure.
You are going to kill civilians because there's nobody else to kill. So it's not like they can kill civilians and say, oh, well, it was a mistake. We apologize. There's nothing to apologize for. This is done in order to kill Palestinian civilians without any doubt, because there is no other choice.
And then, of course, you hear rhetoric, our government uses it too, about surgical strikes, supposed to give you the idea that, precision and, no, it's just not true. Never has.
It's not true, and even with the surgical strikes, let's say they killed somebody who was, I mean, this time they managed to kill Hamas, you know, they kill a Palestinian leader like they do from time to time, or a clergyman, or somebody that they choose to assassinate, but what about all the people around that are killed? They say others. What do you mean by others? Who are these others? Are they? Do they have names? Do they have children? Do they have to feed somebody? What about all the injured? Who's going to take care of them? You know, and like you said, here in the U.S., all people can say is, "Well, Israel has a right to defend itself," which is complete nonsense because it is not defending itself. If the U.S. wanted to do the right thing, the president would call on the Sixth Fleet to come, impose a no-fly zone over Gaza, begin immediate recovery of Gaza, and begin the medical relief for the thousands of injured civilians from the phosphorus bombs and all this other horrific stuff that Israel uses, because there is no medical relief. Israel does not allow medical relief to go in. So the people that were injured are stuck. The hospitals can't help them because they have no... You know, they don't have the tools, they don't have the means to help, because Israel won't allow anything to come in.
Our government's going that direction. That's pretty much what happened after Katrina in New Orleans. It sounds very familiar. I tell you what, Mikko, we got to cut to a break, but we're getting into some very important stuff here. We're going to pick up right there when we get back, folks. Stick with us.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests from various realms of interest share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson for Normal. And like millions of other responsible Americans, I smoke pot. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana. And it's none of the government's business. Let's get the government out of our private lives once and for all and stop arresting smokers. Let's take a stand for personal freedom. To learn how you can help, go to normal.org.
Come, you masters of war.
Hello, this is Cindy Sheehan.
America's war on terror has become a war of terror, with endless drone bombings, continuing military occupation, as well as detention, rendition, and torture still being practiced under the current administration. I lost my precious son Casey to war, and now work towards a day when not one more mother, son, or daughter will suffer such a loss. Listen to my podcast, read my blog, and come join me at any activities I attend near you. Please visit CindySheehanSoapbox.com for more information, and let's work for peace together.
Stellar Flutes is a family-owned and operated business dedicated to producing beautiful, finely handcrafted Native American-style flutes in a variety of sustainable woods. Stellar Flutes are used by both beginner and professional musicians with glowing praise. Easy to play and invoking a calm, meditative feeling, they make a perfect gift for you or someone special. For more information, including videos on selecting and playing the flute, please visit stellarflutes.com or call toll-free 1-888-427-8850.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. Once again, our guest is Miko Peled. He's the son of a former IDF. Actually, what was your father's title? Was he a general? Or
he was a general, yes.
A general. And
that's why
not just any general.
General, I mean, son, yes.
Yeah, he played a major role, as you were saying, in the, helping Israel, you know, initially with its founding. And then later on, he played a big role in the Six-Day War. He was probably as much of a Zionist as one could be, wouldn't you say, initially?
He was completely, and he insisted on being called a Zionist and referred to himself as a Zionist. He was a real believer in the right of the Jewish people to a homeland in Palestine. And I wonder if he would still say this if he was alive today. I think he probably wouldn't. But he was indoctrinated, and he was born there, and he was educated on this ideology, and he was a firm believer. So he was a Zionist through and through. And then, like I said, after the 1967 war, he began parting ways with the Zionist establishment. And sadly enough, he died in 1995, which is when the Oslo peace process was at its height and everybody was still very hopeful. And the very last article, he had a column in one of the Israeli papers, the very last article he wrote and the very last interview, actually, that he gave, he talked about a requiem to Oslo, about the death of Oslo and how the Israeli government really doesn't want peace. And Oslo peace accord is really proof that Israel has no intention of making peace with the Palestinians. They want to destroy the Palestinian economy and not allow the Palestinians any independence at all. So it'd be interesting what people always say to me, what do you think he would say if he was alive today? I think he would call for a democracy with equal rights for the Palestinians on the entire country, which is what I call for, because it's really the only solution that could possibly work.
Right. Actually, I said I wanted to mention your website again. I want to do that now in case sometimes toward the end of the show I get distracted. There's so many things I want to get in before the show's over. So let's mention again your website. It's actually the title of your book, thegeneralsson.com, folks. You can go there and order his book. You can, of course, get it on Amazon as well. But on his website, there's a lot of other information on there. So you just type in The General Son. Obviously, you skip the apostrophe. TheGeneralsSon.com is his website. Anyway, we got some more questions coming in here. This one is from Carl, or Carland, I guess, in New York City. Carland asks, does Miko have a counterpart amongst the Palestinian people to advocate for peace, and if not, why not? I guess any group over there that you're working with? Or?
Well, I have 5.5 million Palestinians who live under Israeli rule, and about another 5 million Palestinians who live in exile, forced into exile by Israel, who all want peace and who all talk about peace all the time. And so, and not to mention thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails who are in jail because they talk about peace. Israel doesn't want Palestinians talking about peace. And then sadly, we've got the memory of countless Palestinians who were killed by Israel, all fighting, all struggling for peace and wanting to achieve peace. So I think I have more counterparts than I could possibly need, and this
of course
is a theme.
I think you said you've been over there too, right? I mean, you've dealt with
this. Oh, I'm there all the time. I'm there all the time. I go there three, four times a year. I'm there all the time. I have many friends there, many people that I work with and speak with and protest with and so forth. And, you know, peace, coexistence, and tolerance are the mainstay of Palestinian culture, of Palestinian society, and Palestinian political thinking. Palestinians have very skillfully, the Israeli lobby and the American press, the media, have managed to create this image of the Palestinians as terrorists, which is it's a lie, it's a myth, it's not true. There has been, of course, there have been acts of violence in Palestinian resistance, and like I said earlier, my sister's little girl was a victim of that. She was killed by suicide bombers.
Sure.
At the same time, that represents a very small portion, a very small fraction of Palestinian resistance to Israel. In a 65-year history of resistance, there have been far more attempts at resolving the problem and resisting nonviolently than there have been violently. Like I said earlier, if we look at the Palestinian prisoner population in Israel, the political prisoners, less than 10% have been charged with acts of violence. The vast majority of them are activists, political activists, who engaged in resistance that is nonviolent, but were punished for that. So the Palestinian resistance is really, and Palestinian culture is not characterized by violence at all. It is characterized by desire to live in peace and tolerance and
sure,
and coexistence.
And then there's the problem. I like to call them the Arabs with Star of David tattoos. I'm referring, of course, to the Mossad. Sometimes they actually launch attacks. Our government does. The CIA does this. We'll launch attacks and frame the Palestinians. Do you see that going on still?
Well, I know they do. They do several things. Israeli. First of all, every time Israel attacks Gaza, they blame the Palestinians for doing something, and which is not true. And the attacks on Gaza have always been initiated by Israel, every single time, in violation. Israel has always been the one to violate ceasefire agreements, not the other way around. But they always blame them. And in the early years, when the State of Israel was created, one of the problems that took place was that Jews did not want to come. And in the 1950s, there were large Jewish populations in Arab countries, and they were doing fine. They were old societies that have been there for centuries, including Iraq. There was a large Jewish community in Iraq. There was a large Jewish community in Kurdistan, in Egypt, in Yemen, in all kinds of Arab countries, in North Africa, in Morocco. But they didn't want to come at first. I mean, Jews didn't want to come. They thought it was a crazy racist idea, and they were quite comfortable where they were. So the Mossad did go. And many of these Mossad cells were actually caught and punished and tried to put bombs in synagogues and so forth in order to scare the Jews to come to Israel.
Right.
And eventually they created a situation where they implicated entire Jewish communities with these crimes, and then eventually they many of them had to get up and leave. But, they will stop at nothing. I mean, people, are not really quite able to understand the depth of what Israel is capable of doing in order to push its agenda, both here in this country and around the world.
I've noticed over the years, I've seen quite a few articles in Haaretz, Jerusalem Post, that are actually quite critical of Israel. There was one article back in April of 2007, I remember, where Haaretz was saying that it's now clear Israel doesn't want peace. Its claims ring hollow. It's amazing because you never see that over here. There's actually more freedom, it appears, in the Israeli press about Israel's dealings with the Palestinians than what we have here.
That's true. There's much more freedom of speech on this issue. There's much more freedom of academic freedom on this issue in Israel. And the thing is, Israel, with all its atrocities towards Palestinians, is a democracy for Israeli Jews. So if you're an Israeli Jew, you do live in a democracy, and the discussion and on this issue is far more open over there than it is here, without any doubt. You're absolutely right.
It's quite a twist. And then, of course, we were talking about Mossad and some of their dealings. Of course, you can go back to the beginning. You had the Irgun thing with Menachem Begin. They claim to be against terrorism, but there they were engaging in terrorism. The King David hotel bombing, on and on it goes. But it's also been revealed in Haaretz that Israel, going back to the 1970s, was actually supporting, its own opposition, Hamas.
Well, it's true that Israel allowed you know, they saw Hamas as a positive opposition to the PLO that Israel didn't like at the time. Now, of course, they regret that, but they did help that. But you know, when we talk about Israeli terrorism, people always refer to, you know, the King David Hotel and so forth. But you know, the worst act of terrorism that Israel ever conducted is actually the creation of the State of Israel, because the creation of the State of Israel was made possible when the Israeli army conducted a massive campaign of terrorizing and ethnic cleansing. You know, not, almost 90% of Palestine's population was forced out of Palestine, close to 1 million people. You know, and it's not like there was a war. It was a massive campaign of ethnic cleansing that was initiated by the Israeli forces, that was executed by the Israeli forces, and then it was Israeli forces that made sure that, you know, that the Palestinians who went into refugee camps remained in refugee camps and were not permitted to come back to their homes, and they kept the borders, and anybody who tried to go back was shot at sight. And you have cases of many, many cases of people who were shot as they were trying to go back home. So this is a massive, this is such an act of terrorism that is so big that it's almost unbelievable that it is so rarely mentioned.
Yeah, the very type of thing that's been attributed, of course, to Nazi Germany.
Well, I mean, as far as genocide is concerned, you know, Nazi Germany was a little more effective and numbers were bigger, but certainly genocide is genocide.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, we got some more questions I want to go to here. The clock is ticking down on us, but I wanted to get this in before the show ends. I'm sure your father would be proud if he was still around. Then again, if he's up there looking down, I'm sure he's proud to see you're serving his memory well in what you're doing. I'm sure your mother and your whole family is proud as well that you've come around. Did your father ever try to... you know, quote, convert you, or you just kind of let you do your own thing, or?
Well, you know, this was the discussion at the dinner table every night. You know, this was the issue for him. You know, the State of Israel and the situation in Israel and so forth was part of his life, was part of his duty, was part of what you do, you know? So, I mean, you know, his life was completely dedicated to this cause and to this issue. So this was what he talked about, read about, wrote about, and you know. So, yeah, we were talked about this all the time.
Wow.
As you can imagine.
Sure. Let's see. We got a question here from Amy in Florida. She asks, is Miko in the U.S., which, of course, you are.
Yeah.
And how does the Israeli government view him? Is he viewed as, I kind of asked this earlier, are you viewed as a traitor? I'll tell you what, in addition to that, I would like to add, have you had any trouble getting in and out of Israel?
No, like I said, you know, for Israeli Jews, Israel is a democracy. And so there is no problem for Israeli Jews to say what they think and write what they think and so forth. So I haven't had... And I don't, you know, there's very, I know of only one case of an Israeli who had actually had any kind of trouble with Israeli authorities coming in and out. But it's not common at all. None of the activists that I know have ever had any kind of trouble because Israel, like I said, it's a democracy for Israeli Jews. We are allowed to say what we think and write what we think and express our views.
Except if you were 18 and trying to get out of service.
I'm sorry?
Except if you were 18 and you were trying to get out of military service.
Exactly. Then they don't allow that. That's true.
Yeah.
They don't allow that.
Wow. I didn't know that you could get out of it, though, at all. That's interesting.
It's very easy. The Israeli army is far too big for its needs. And they don't want to deal with people who are less than motivated to be part of it.
Yeah.
So they're quite happy to let people out. Why deal with all kinds of problems? But they won't recognize conscientious objection because how could you object to something that is inherently right, which is, of course, they feel that they are representing the moral high ground. And so they don't permit that.
Right, right. Let's see. We've got another question here. This is from Oren here in the U.S. He says, do you believe that the Israelis used white phosphorus on innocent civilians, and if so, why hasn't this war crime been prosecuted?
Well, it's not that I believe. There's concrete evidence
Sure.
That Israel has used white phosphorus for years and years and years. They used it in Lebanon in the 80s. They've used it in every single war and they used it in Gaza every single time they attack. And the stories of babies burning and doctors unable to extinguish the burns, to extinguish the fire, are some of the most horrific stories that one could possibly hear. You know, after the people die, the burning doesn't stop because of what, it's impossible. It's practically impossible to stop the white phosphorus. And there was a little girl, a 5-year-old girl here, who came for treatment here in the U.S. Because she had to have so much plastic surgery done on her. And you see this wonderfully sweet, beautiful little 5-year-old girl with scars, the burn scars, all over her body. Now, why Israel nobody prosecutes Israel. I mean, I think there's definitely a movement going in that direction, and I'm confident that Israeli generals and commanders will be brought to the International Criminal Court. Now that Palestine has been, and this is the good thing about the UN vote, now that Palestine has been recognized as a state, it has the ability to bring Israel to the International Criminal Court. Whether they'll do it or not is another issue, but there's no question that Israel, and Israeli commanders and politicians have to be brought to the ICC for their crimes against
the
Palestinians, and certainly the white phosphorus is a big part of that. I just read a horrifying description of doctors trying to extinguish the white phosphorus on babies, and it's just horrific.
My. Well, of course, our own military has a very bad track record there, too. Depleted uranium, Agent Orange, napalm, bombing innocent civilian targets in Cambodia, Laos, on and on it goes. There was no need whatsoever to bomb Cambodia or Laos. Of course, pretty much any other place we've gone, for that matter.
But, I think what I do think, and I know our time's probably running out, but I do think it's important to kind of, probably the most common comment I get about the book is how hopeful it is. And even Alice Walker, who was, kind enough to write the foreword to the book, said it's one of the most hopeful things she's ever read about this issue. And I think it's important to realize that there is hope. There is hope because Israelis and Palestinians, once the state of Israel has transformed into a democracy, it's no longer a Jewish state, but it's a state of all of its people, all of its citizens. And Israelis and Palestinians can vote as equals and live as equals and share the resources as equals and so forth. You have two very, very positive societies in general. You have two societies that are highly educated, that are ready to go to work, that are highly positive, that have democratic traditions. And they can really create something unique in that beautiful country. It's a beautiful country with a lot of promise and a lot of resources and a wonderful history as well. And so I'm very optimistic that we're going to see this transformation, just like we saw in South Africa when apartheid fell, and just like we saw the Berlin Wall fall and we saw Mubarak in Egypt fall. I think it's going to be a lot sooner than most people think that we see the state of Israel as it is today fall and a very positive political transformation takes place that allows everybody, all Israelis and Palestinians, to really live as equal and not only share the country but share their future and share the state.
Yeah. Before time runs out, I don't know if we're going to get time to get everything in. I wanted to ask you. I'm sure you're familiar with Mr. Sabrowski.
I don't know that I am.
Well, someone's asking me to ask you about if you think there may have been an involvement with in 9/11 on the part of the Israeli government.
I'm not much of a believer in conspiracies, and I've never seen any evidence, and I can't imagine why there would be any involvement of Israel in 9/11. So I can't answer that.
Okay, let's see. I'm trying to get to as many questions as I can here. We got like two more minutes left. Well, I'll tell you, as far as that goes, I'll put my two cents in. The official story of what happened that day just doesn't add up. I don't know if you've ever looked into it.
Yeah, that I know. I know that there are a lot of holes in the story, but I haven't seen anything that would make me think that Israel had anything to do with it.
Okay. Let's see. We got Chirper in Canada asks, is it possible Israel had any? I'm repeating myself. We got another one here. Do you think that Israel might have had anything to do. Oh, my goodness, this is the same question that keeps coming in. We've got a lot of people asking this. Yeah, Zabrowski is the one. He's an Israeli. He has come out and stated that. Apparently you're not familiar with his work. No. Well, anyway, I guess we covered all the bases, everything I wanted to ask you. I want to commend you once again, though. This, unfortunately, seems to be pretty rare for an Israeli to come out, and like you said, it is rare. But at least Jews in this country, there's a trend, things are changing, and I want to commend you, you know, for the work you're doing and encourage you. I don't think you need encouragement, but, you know, to encourage you to keep going in this direction because, like you said, the tide is turning. Have you ever been to Europe and given any talks over there? Because I know there's a lot of people.
Yes, I have. I've given several talks in Europe. I've given talks in Australia. I've got a full calendar of talks. I've got a little break this month, but starting January, I'm off to the Middle East and then to Europe and then Asia and then back here in the country. And I've got you know, I'm scheduled to speak up and down the country, really everywhere. And so I'm everywhere speaking, and people can see my schedule too. They can see my my itinerary on thegeneralsun.com. My schedule of speaking engagements are there too, so they can, if I'm come to town, you'll be able to see when I'm there and when I'm in Boston and in other places too.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm going to try to catch you in March when you're going to be up this way.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That could work out. All right, well, Miko, I want to thank you. You got a great book, and folks, once again, go check it out. All you got to do is just go to thegeneralsun.com or just go to amazon.com and type in the title or just type in his name, Miko Peled, that's P-E-L-E-D, and of course his first name, Miko, is M-I-K-O, and you can get his book that way. But do check out his website. There's a lot more great information on there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
You bet. Okay, folks, join us again next week. We're going to have Medea Benjamin and Ty Barry on of Code Pink. And they're going to be talking about their recent trip to Palestine protesting drone bombing. So that should be a very interesting show. In the meantime, have a great week, folks, and we'll catch you then. Take care.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.